and welcome to Parenting Help with Vigeo Behavior Consulting. Join us for conversations with experts in the fields of cognitive behavior, mental health, behavior analysis, education, and child psychology. On this podcast, we examine the challenges that parents are facing and share insights and strategies that have helped other parents with similar issues. I'm your host, Katie Palmer. I'm a parenting coach and board-certified behavior analyst. I'm also the owner of Vigeo Behavior Consulting. I am fortunate to be able to engage in conversations with some incredible professionals whose depth and breadth of experience can offer guidance for parents who are looking for new ideas. I hope you find this podcast useful, engaging, and insightful. A quick pre-show note for our audience, we are excited to have on our training platform the first in-depth training series for providers who would like to use the MAGPIES program in their work with children. Dr. Cassidy and Dr. Stapleton will offer 5 live webinars, which will also be available on demand. Head over to our website, vigeobx.com, and click courses for all the details. After hearing what can be accomplished and how the program was developed, you won't want to miss the opportunity to attend these trainings and start delivering the program. Enjoy the episode. Hello to Dr. Cassidy and Dr. Stapleton. Welcome back. I'm so excited to have you both here with us, and I know our audience has met you both before. But today we are here especially to talk about a new program that you have developed as a group intervention for, is it teens or young children or both?
Children between the ages of 8 and 12, although we have used it, you know, slightly on the edges of that too.
Wonderful. And I'll let you introduce the program, including the name, which has a little bit of a story behind it, right?
Sure, yeah. Actually, MAGPIES was developed at a time when there weren't a lot of children's mental health programs out there, and there wasn't a lot of ACT being done for kids. And so the reason I called it MAGPIES was kind of a joke, because at the time I felt like I was doing there was a reasonable amount of ACT being done with adults, and there was probably a good few protocols out there using CBT. Mm-hmm. For children. So I felt like everything I was doing or that I was learning about at conferences, I was either actifying the CBT stuff or I was kidifying the ACT stuff. So I found anytime I was learning something new, I was sort of taking all the shiny bits and bringing them home to the clinic and using them with the children that I was working here with in the clinic. So MAGPIES was sort of the amalgamation of all the different things that I was learning other places, but I was kind of, you know, polishing them off and making them my own or our own for the kids that we were working here with here in Smithfield Clinic.
I know that. So growing up in Vermont, we didn't have MAGPIES. Okay. I didn't even know what a magpie was until I visited Ireland, and we do have them out here in the West, but they are a type of bird that is attracted to or will chase shiny things, right?
Yeah. And I suppose I'm also a person that chases a lot of shiny things anyway, like if something grabs my interest. So I often make that joke, like that I'm, you know, off chasing shiny things. So, you know, the idea of the magpie is quite a funny one to me anyway. So, yeah.
Dr. Stapleton, how was it that you became involved with the development and growth of this program?
I had seen Sarah on a panel in ACBS in Dublin. I think it must have been 2019. And the way Sarah spoke on that panel made me cry. And as someone who doesn't cry much, let alone cry in public, I just felt really, really drawn to Sarah. And I had been, you know, following her work since then, and I'd heard of her before. And then I had the opportunity to complete a training with her early 2020. And it was the last in-person training that I had attended before COVID. And I remember finding that just equally transformative for myself. So then when the opportunity came up to actually work with Sarah in a closer capacity, on something that interested me already, which was youth mental health. No way I could say no to that, right? So it's just been, it's been good since then.
That's fantastic. I'm always interested in those moments that touch us deeply. And I think I asked Sarah this question when we spoke, when you and Lisa were on the podcast. And Allison, may I call you Allison? Is that all right?
Yep.
What was it in that training that touched you? What was it about the way she spoke that moved you so much?
It feels hard to pick one thing, and it's funny to say this out loud in front of Sarah. I don't know if we've actually talked about this.
No, we haven't actually. This is the first time. This feels like a therapy session.
Beautiful moment in the room right now. I'm live on the podcast.
Yeah, I feel like there were so many individual moments that I remember that have just really stuck with me since completing that training. But there's one that I always use when people ask me to explain Sarah Cassidy, and it's Sarah played us a song, who I can't recall the name of them right now. I'll remember it later and kick myself, but it's called Addicted to You. And Sarah shared that song as an example of, you know, how intense things might feel when we're a young person versus how we might reframe them when we look back as an adult. And I remember that really sticking with me because, you know, I was kind of young myself when I was attending that training, and realizing, oh, me in the past would have really benefited from understanding that people who were my senior at the time weren't necessarily seeing my end of the world as my end of the world, whereas it might have felt that way for me in that moment. So, you know, Sarah has a lot of nuggets of wisdom that she passes on, but that was one that really stuck with me from that particular training.
That awareness of the perspective of a young person is, I feel, so important to working with young people or working with parents of young people. So that component of when we are young, things feel so big. And as we get older, we look back and think, well, that was not as big as it felt. But when we're working with young people or when we're parenting young people, jumping back into that mindset of, oh, this is really big, it's a beautiful place to start, but a beautiful place to sit in approaching work with these kids. So Magpies, can you tell me a little bit about its development and how you designed it and how you've begun testing it? You've had some studies to determine whether it's effective. Is that correct?
Yes, we have. So we have been working on it a long time, and I know we might have touched on this in previous podcasts, so I don't want to repeat myself too much. But initially I was doing Magpies kind of as I described, just, you know, taking little bits and pieces. And one of the things that struck me is that I feel like you can do really good therapy here in one session with a child, but then the parents need to know a little bit, and maybe the teachers need to know a little bit, and what happens then when they go out into space or out into the real world, and they can't then generalize whatever great things you've been working on. And so I felt like there needs to be a little bit more, like there needs to be something where whatever it is that you're working on has to go farther than that. So it was always my practice to, like, if I had designed session notes based on whatever my Magpies tools were, you know, whatever technique or strategy or, you know, whatever shiny bits I was bringing into the session and whatever great things I felt we were doing and we were trying on, or, you know, if it was anxiety we were working on or emotional regulation, you know, I might try to model that with the parent and the child, you know, maybe even in the hallway as we're leaving the session, here's 5 minutes and here, let's try this thing. Here's the thing that we're doing or that we're using. And can you try this on at home or during the week? And the other thing I got in the habit of doing was, you know, letting the parent have a copy of my session notes with whatever kind of a script of, you know, here's what we're actually working on. Practice this at home with your brother, your sister, your mom, your dad. Now, initially, these were individual exercises. But my hope was that if this child was working with a resource teacher or even just chatting with mom or dad, that they could practice this stuff at home in their real life settings. Because, of course, whatever they're doing, you know, with me or with Allison or you know, whatever setting they're working in might be really, really helpful. But it's not going to be that great unless they can actually do it in real life where real life is happening. And so, you know, I've been doing this therapy individually, and a school principal approached me and said, you know, I wonder if you would think about doing this in the classroom. You know, they had at the time, they were calling it an EBD unit. The language around that has changed now. And anyway, he wanted to know, would I do this program? And it tended to be that parents or teachers or whomever, when they were sending a kid for therapy in the clinic, they tended to cluster around these areas. You know, people were coming for what they called at the time anger management. So we're going back a lot of years now. We now right. call it emotional regulation. People were coming for the management of anxiety. I might now call that sort of coping. You know, again, I think language changes and grows across time. Building of self-esteem or social skills. And so they tended to kind of group in those areas, and I'll let Allison jump in here now in a minute too. But the school principal essentially said to me, you know, can you do a program for us? We're going to lose our unit, because a lot of the kids that are attending our unit, because they're not attending their local child and adolescent mental health team, they're going to lose access to this unit for various reasons I won't get into, but they're going to lose access to this unit. In fact, this particular unit was going to get closed down. So can you build a program for our unit? And I thought, huh, you know, well, I don't actually have a lot of time, but this feels like a really important project. And I've got all these kind of tailored programs that I've been working on for these kids that have been attending for the building of self-esteem, the coping of anxiety, the reducing of, you know, what parents were calling at the time, anger management. And of course, lots of kids were coming for things like social skills. And I thought, yeah, I could probably, I've got a lot of these collections of my notes. I've got a lot of these strategies that I've been collecting across time. I probably could put these into, you know, something that I could share with teachers. I've kind of been sharing them with parents for a lot, you know, I've kind of got a few, you know, 10 session protocols, if I could just tidy these up. So we started putting it into a more structured program and started delivering it in this school. And, you know, across time, then we've made it a little bit more structured. And initially it was myself, just myself delivering it. And then my good friend and colleague, Dr. Steve Gannon, was helping to deliver it at this school. And another good friend and colleague, Sarah Mayo Cisternas, who's an ed psych now in the UK. And then Dr. L. Kirsten, who I believe you've also had on. Now the extraordinary Dr. Allison Stapleton. And when Elle came on board, we started formally collecting data. And now that Allison is with us, we're also collecting a lot more data. So I'm gonna let Allison jump in now and talk a little bit more about the data collection that we've been doing.
So we have data going back, or I suppose standardized measures going back the past 3 years, but I would say that Magpies has always been guided by data in some form. So whether it was those formal standardized pre-post measures, or whether it was feedback from kids in the sessions in the moment, maybe it was parents getting in touch after the fact, there's always been some form of evidence that's been guiding Magpies. And whether that was the actual exercises that were being used on the day, or maybe the more formal structure of protocols going forward, there's always been some evidence and some form of data leading the way that Magpies looks, which has gotten into where it is today as well.
There's a wonderful balance I hear in bringing in the voice, the participants' voices, parents and students' feedback and reflections on the program, as well as those standardized measures, which maybe we can publish in certain journals. A study that uses standardized measures, but can you talk a little bit about the value of that feedback from the participants and how that helps you determine what adjustments to make?
It's so interesting you ask about that, because I keep promising people this manual. And one of the reasons the manual has been so slow to be written is because we keep changing the exercise based on the feedback that we're getting from children and from families. And every time we run a different module, we change things based on, it might be the movement needs of the group, it might be something a parent tells us, it might be something just one individual kid tells us. And of course, a lot of the kids that attend our groups are neurodivergent kids. So they may not be, like, they're all kids that have some mental health difficulties, and they're all kids that have needs that typically, or you know, that sort of collect in those areas that we're talking about. But they're all also kids that have mental health difficulties, and they're all kids that are struggling in some way, shape, or form. But we've been driven every single time by the things that these kids tell us. So if a child says to us, this particular exercise is boring, or I don't like it, or it doesn't work for me, you know, we're looking at what they're telling us, but we're also looking at how, you know, their behavior changes over time, or we're looking at maybe what their parents are telling us after the group. We're looking at what works and what doesn't work, how our clinicians are observing them in session. So there's lots of different types of data points. We're even looking at kind of session length, time of day. You know, there's so much different data that we're, you know, gathering up, and a lot of it is probably unpublishable. You know, like, most of the things are never going to make it into any sort of a journal, but it's been really a rich learning experience for us. And, you know, most of the qualitative data that we've garnered has been so rich and so nuanced, and, you know, far more than you'd ever really get out of any kind of a journal article, in my opinion.
I love this concept of, we are always improving based on continuing feedback. And I'm sure that, you know, that there's a lot of models out there in business and education. I hear a lot about feedback, creating change. And now I'm thinking, like, if I showed up and said to a school, like, here's this program, or I said to a group of parents, here's this program, here's how it was developed. It's very, very rich and deep. And so I want to say the word generative. I don't even know if that's appropriate here, but it comes out of the needs of the people that it's designed to serve. And I'm not sure that that happens very often. And now I'm getting more excited about what's in it. So can we shift a little bit and talk about the modules, like the components of the program? And I have gone through some of the initial training that was provided. So I know some of the exercises, but can you talk a little bit about those modules and how you organize them around the needs that we're presenting?
So emotional regulation, we usually start with emotional regulation, although I should say we don't have data on, you know, there's not necessarily an order that you should necessarily, you know, take MAGPIES in if you were a kid that was attending, if you were a parent that was looking to send your child to MAGPIES. So emotional regulation is a really fun one. And actually, when Alison mentions that Addicted to You, that particular song that I also really love, I often think we talk about kids, or we talk about people, like, as super feelers. And, like, when you're in this, like, intense emotional period of your life, which can be any period of your life, trying to make a decision when you're in this, like, intense moment and everything feels so enormous, and you're in the eye of a storm, you know, how could you make a really important decision then? And if I were talking to a parent, and, you know, and, like, you know, Alison mentioned that song Addicted to You, which, by the way, is not part of the MAGPIES program, unfortunately, because we don't own the song. But I might, you know, play, like, a song that was really, really evocative. And then I might ask you, like, now, how much do you care about a maths test? You know, like, if you're in the middle of an intense, something that's intense and emotional to you, how much do you care about a maths test? So, and of course, the answer is, you know, not at all. Because right now, like, I'm in the midst of, like, a fight with my boyfriend, or, you know, like, I'm something really, really difficult has just happened for me, and I'm feeling like something is intensely unfair. And so, like, what we're trying to do in emotional regulation is we are not trying to squash the super feeler. We are not trying to tell a child that what they are thinking and feeling in those moments are wrong. But what we might be trying to do, like, some of the exercises might include things like, you know, we look at some of the classic things in ACT might be things like dropping anchor, or, you know, something like grounding. One thing I love, I call it the bold skills.
Remember that from the training? I would love to hear
one of my favorites. That's one of my favorites. And of course, I didn't invent that. I saw that originally in one of Louise Hayes and Joe Ciarocchi's early books. I think it's Get Out of Your Life, Get Out of Your Mind and Into Your Life for Teens. But I just tweaked it to make the language a little bit younger in that. But it's B is breathe. Your breath is your anchor and it's always with you. O is observe what's happening in your mind and your body. L is for listen. What's the most important thing to you right now? And D is decide, you know, what are you going to do in this moment that's going to bring you closer to what's the most important thing to you right now? And the reason I really like bold, and of course I know you're in the States, but we're here in Ireland, and everybody in Ireland, it's like a thing that they would say to kids, don't be bold, stop being bold. And there's a lot of this kind of, you know, wagging your finger. So like to tell a child in Ireland to practice being bold, I think is like a really funny shift in perspective, when I would actually write on a piece of paper, you know, to a kid, now I want you to go home and practice being bold. And everybody thinks that's funny and they remember it. But like we would write down, you know, to practice being bold and what makes you bold. And but we really actively practice those things, you know, breathing, your breath is your anchor. And we've talked a lot about dropping anchor. And again, there's nothing, you know, pathologizing about anything in Magpies. You know, we're never, ever telling a kid you are wrong for having these really strong feelings. These things are normal, you know, in the course of a life that's stormy. However, we are going to teach you some skills that might be useful when things get stormy. So there's a lot in teaching us about who we are in the world, and it's good to be who you are in the world. And let's think about how we navigate that. So ER is about, you know, regulating your emotions, not about you know, changing them, getting rid of them. It's about, you know, what can we do that's useful if you find yourself in the middle of a storm and what you tend to do doesn't work for you in that moment, or doesn't get you what you need out of your life in that moment. So there's loads of, I won't labor too much on that. But yeah, lots of cool stuff. You know, we talk about, like, you know, different parts of your brain and, you know, your five senses. And so we do a lot of cool stuff there. Do you want to say any more about ER, or will I talk about all the else and jump in?
It might be good for us to say out loud as well that it's not about getting into a battle with the kids about the truth of how big their issues are in that moment. Like, our frame of reference for, you know, whether something is a big issue or not is totally different from that child who's experiencing that issue in their life right now. And so we wouldn't focus on whether it is or isn't a big problem, but how are you responding to that problem, and is it serving you in the long term? You know, according to who and by what metric, or how do we know that it's actually working for you? And I think the other thing that we emphasize quite a lot in the ER module is, you know, that privilege of a pause, you know, being able to take a breath and, you know, be authentic in a given moment is not something that is safe for every kid to do. So kind of helping them to recognize times where, you know, it is safe and it will serve them in the long run to have that authentic response, or to advocate for themselves and, you know, to respond to their emotions, and also recognize times where they might be unsafe. And what can we do in those moments so that they can get to a place of safety?
Alison, could you tell me just a little bit? We could go so deep on this, but could you tell me a little bit about teaching a child that process of And I suppose it's in that decision point, or maybe even before the breath, like, how do I know what's going to serve me in this moment? As you just described, sometimes I feel safe to take a pause and sometimes I don't. Can you give us any insight on how to help a child with that part of the process before they even engage it with a skill that they've learned potentially in the Magpies program?
I think a lot of the way that it's presented in Magpies relates to tracking your experience, which is kind of a fancy way of saying, tune into your body. What signals is my body giving me in this moment? You know, what signals are out there in the world around me that might help me decide if this is a move that's safe for me or not safe for me? What feedback have I gotten in the past, or what's happened in the past when I've responded this way? And even within that, knowing that sometimes it feels like we don't even have space to begin asking those questions. You know, sometimes we might be quote unquote acting without thinking, it just happens. And when that happens, also being compassionate to ourselves with, yes, okay, this is something that did happen in the past, and this doesn't need to define who I am forever. So, you know, I made a choice in that moment that wasn't a wise choice, and there's another choice point right here in front of me where I have the opportunity to make a wise choice here and now.
I talk so much about that idea of noticing and tracking our experience internally and tracking what's happening externally. It's just a skill, I think, that we never can master. Like, we can always be learning more about how to do that well. Thank you. So that's a bit about the emotional regulation component.
Mm-hmm. And then I suppose important to note, like, while the modules, like, we have them laid out as discrete modules, but they're not really discrete modules. So, like, there's a little bit about, you know, regulation, there's a little bit of mindfulness, you know, self and other awareness, you know, that is sort of woven through all of them. And the concept of safety, you know, that Alison mentioned, or pausing, I think that's through all of them as well. And kind of acceptance and compassion for who you are, that's also woven through all of them. And the whole program is explicitly neuroaffirmative. The Magpies program wasn't designed to be a program that was for neurodivergent kids, but it just happens that the vast majority of the kids that attend us just happen to be, you know, predominantly neurodivergent kids. And so we are explicitly a neuroaffirmative program. So I think that concept of safety, I think, is really, really important, because a lot of the kids that we work with have a lot of sensory processing differences. And so a lot of those kids are on high alert a lot of the time. And that's really, really important then when we move into modules. So like when you're talking about social skills, I was always struck by the fact that a lot of the kids that were attending me for social skills training and were kids that had been bullied. And that always bothered me, because, you know, those were not the kids that really should, you know, in air quotes, I know your viewers or listeners can't see me, you know, those weren't the kids that should be attending for social skills training. And yet those were the kids that were in the room. So when we're thinking about social skills training, you know, I really conceptualize that more as self and other awareness, where we're thinking more about assertiveness, where we're thinking about, you know, if you're in a situation where, you know, we're not trying to change who you are, but is there something in a situation where it might be useful to you to do something that gets you what you need out of this situation? And so we're never trying to change your personhood. Like, your personhood is exactly as it should be. You know, there's nothing wrong with who you are in the world, you know, but thinking about, like, having an awareness of who you are and your ways of being in the world, we wholly respect them. And, you know, are there things in, you know, are there things or ways that you want to access? You know, are there ways that it's useful to be aware of? You know, there have been a lot of ways of teaching social skills that have been really insulting to a lot of humans. And we're really, really conscious of that and not wanting to do that. But I always think there's this, like, you know, even when I think about my own kids, like, where's the magic in the middle? You know, and I've had, you know, conversations with my own kids where, you know, I might ask them a question and they might snap at me. And like, I don't want to be the tone police, but I know that the way that they've spoken to me actually is really insulting. So like, I also want to give them information that actually that way of speaking to somebody is probably not going to work for you going forward. And I'm always imagining like, God, if you spoke to a boss or spoke to a teacher in that tone, how's that going to work? You know? And so like, I'm trying to think about like the utility of this and the usefulness of that versus being the tone police. You must never speak to me like that. You know, you must always look me in the eye. I don't want to do that. Like, I don't want to force a person into a way of being that isn't their natural, comfortable way of being. And yet sometimes there are useful things. So like, you know, let's imagine you're ordering something in a restaurant. You know, is it useful to speak in a certain tone of voice? Is it useful to alert a waiter that you are in fact speaking to them? And then eye contact might be useful, you know, briefly. We're never going to force somebody to do that. But what are the circumstances under which that might be useful? But I think we need to be conscious of this, and we need to think about self and other awareness rather than here is a way in the world that you must be, and instead shift towards respectful, conscious ways of being while also understanding and respecting your ways of being.
I also heard in what you said, I heard a beautiful model of the bold process, where you were able to take that pause if your child snaps at you, and all of our children snap at us. You take the pause, you take a breath, you look at what's going on, you hear, and then that decision point looked in the future of how, what would serve them best. What can I give my child in this moment that will serve them as a way to look at how they are behaving?
I feel that it's difficult because, like, I think, you know, I think we've all been parented or taught from a compliance approach. And I think this is tricky. Like, I see this, you know, I'm a parent and I want my kids to do what I tell them. I really do. I'm not going to lie about that. When I say it's bedtime, I mean it. I don't mean like do what you like. I don't mean that. I mean get to bed. And when it's bedtime and nobody's listening, that makes me angry. I'm not going to lie about that. I'm not going to say I'm dysregulated. I'm angry. And so it's really tricky, I think, to think about how can I respectfully have a kid do a thing that's going to work for them in their larger life, where I'm not trying to, you know, force a child to comply with me because I demand that you do it. Like, you know, I don't want to just demand that a kid does everything that I want them to do, but it's really frustrating, you know, to me as a parent or to a teacher that's out there. You know, like, I might know that there's a particular thing I want a kid to do that's really going to work for them, and I can see them not doing it. And I can see that it's frustrating to them that I keep asking them to eat a healthy dinner or to do their homework or to practice their tin whistle. Why aren't you doing the damn thing? But how do I get them to do it? Or like, how do I evoke that without forcing them to do it? And then where it comes to things like social skills, like, when did that become a skill?
Mm-hmm.
It's slippery, I think. It's a slippery concept. Sorry, I want to bring Allison in on that piece, because I think the neuroaffirmative piece of that is really important too.
Yeah, I think it's really important, and it's something that's been a relatively newer interest for me. It's only been the past couple of years that I've been able to read more about it and learn more. I guess just a couple of things that came to mind for me there, like, when we say, is something useful or is something working for a kid? In Magpies, we have almost the luxury of time. We're able to slow down and talk about what do we actually mean when we say those words, and how is a kid understanding those words? And if a child is using different words to mean the same thing that we're talking about, well, then just going with the child's language on that. So, you know, is this serving you in the long run is not something that I would expect every 8-year-old kid out there to say. And if they're saying it in a different way, but it has that same meaning and is understood in the same way, than going with that in the moment too. I think in terms of social skills, it is a really complicated issue. And a lot of the programs I've seen for young people and even adults tend to be, from my perspective, all or nothing. So it's either learn these neurotypical social skills or be your authentic self all the time. And my personal opinion is that that would not be helpful and not be safe for a lot of people in a lot of contexts. Something when we talk about neuroaffirming practice is that emphasis on the environment. So it's like in a world of systems that are actively failing you or, you know, actively failing a child, how can they be their authentic selves in a safe way that helps them get what they need from that environment so that they can live a fulfilling and meaningful life? I think those are a lot of the really challenging questions that come up when we talk about social skills, because it can be useful to have response options available to you. Like if I'm going for a job interview, it might be useful for me to know, oh, sometimes people use eye contact as an indicator of, you know, assertiveness or this other, you know, pop psych jargon I don't have in my brain in this moment, but it might be useful for me to have those response options available. And at the same time, never losing sight of the fact that, you know, these are kids not in a vacuum, but in systems. And it ideally should be the environment that changes first. And people are working on it, but the environments haven't changed quickly enough. And in the meantime, there are a lot of kids who could benefit from, you know, what I think of as almost a class in a range of social skills, a range of different ways of being. You know, how can we communicate with others, advocate for ourselves, and also respect others, and that recognition of collective group strength.
Yeah. Yeah, there's so much choice built into to what you're saying about, can a person learn enough skills that when they are in a particular context, they recognize there's a choice to make and what choice might be best for them in that moment, in that context, in that environment, rather than feeling that they have to change as a person to make that choice, knowing that this is a temporary choice. I'm making this choice to engage in this behavior in this environment, and I am still exactly who I am. It was a wonderful, just a wonderful foundation for, you know, bringing any kind of program to parents and children. I'm getting really excited right now, so I'm losing my words.
Yeah. But there are useful things. And again, I like that Alison brought about the concept of safety, because I think that's really important, like establishing that as a safe base and teaching these skills early on and thinking about, you know, these are things that we can learn, you know, not everybody, and like learning and practicing, you know, and knowing that there might be times when they ebb and flow, and even at different points in our day, you know, you might feel like you've got like a lot of language right now, or you've got a lot of social skill or capital or, you know, battery right now. And there might be other times where you feel a little bit low in those things, whether it's, you know, your level of regulation or your level of social skill or battery. And there are other times when it's high and times when it's low, and, you know, but being aware that that is ever changing and that means that it can grow too.
Is
important. Yeah. And something else I want to add, there was something that I learned during my time in the States, that they don't teach here in Ireland, but I remember taking this speech class. I don't know if this is familiar to you, Katie, but it was really useful. And I remember comparing kind of my, I have nieces that live in the States and then my own kids here. And, you know, some of the things they might've known, let's say from like a biology class or something. And, you know, my own, my eldest kid, but I remember him having conversations with a niece of mine that was a similar age. But I think my niece had probably done these speech classes that I also did. And my own young lad, who would have been very bright and possibly knew some of the same things, but wasn't just able to deliver it in the same way as my niece could deliver it. And I remember thinking back to these speech classes that I had taken, where they teach you to, you know, stand upright and make eye contact and look around the members of the audience and hold eye contact for exactly, you know, 3 seconds and then move on to the next member of the audience. But I remember, like, when I was, you know, delivering, you know, professional presentations early on when I was doing my PhD. And I remember all the rules of speech class. And I remember thinking, oh, yeah, that's useful, you know. And it was really useful to know those things. And I remember Brian Roach, my PhD supervisor, saying, gosh, you're the most confident speaker that I have ever taught. And I was like, yeah, well, thanks to years and years of taking this speech class. But I think Irish kids don't have that. And that was just something that was useful, you know, and it's though that was explicitly taught to me. I don't think that changed me as a person. I actually think that was useful.
So it's a skill that you were taught, that you were able to place onto a situation when it was useful. And my guess is, from having seen you present recently, that those skills have flexed now and they are not as rigid or as forced, if you will. They're not put on like a hat, but they have integrated well with who you are and your delivery method. I always think of when, like, the idea of, okay, sometimes we put on a skill like a coat, but it doesn't mean I'm a different person under the coat. And, you know, we can carry it with us and we can take it off when it's no longer cold or when we no longer need to wear it. So this is a metaphor I've just come up with.
Yeah, and that's a nice one. And I think there's an exercise similar to that in the self-esteem module. We do a lot of this kind of who are you and who are you and who are you, you know, until we run out of, you know, when do you get to the end of the road? So it's like, when have you run out of coats, Katie? You know, yes. Or like, what's the end of you? Like, actually, there's no end of you. There's no end. You know, I think the cool chameleon exercise was one that we see in ACT. I think that came to that, Alison, did that come from, was that one of Dana Palaluna's exercises, yeah. I think? So there's a few cool exercises essentially looking at who are you? And we have talked about in Magpies, and there's lots of different exercises where we explore this, but essentially there are lots of different versions of you. And, you know, the you that you bring to your maths class might be a different you that you bring to a sports team, might be a different you that's sitting at dinner with your family, might be a different you that's snuggled up watching telly late at night, but all of those are still you. You know, that it doesn't mean that you're no longer you. It's just a different, you know, set of skills or a different way of being. You know, you might have a different stance or a different posture or different clothing on, but it's still you.
Yeah.
And I think I might be dwelling a little bit too much. I think we could talk for probably several hours just about social skills alone, but it might be really important for us to name the impact of masking as well. Because Magpies is, you know, actively against teaching people to mask all the time, 24/7. That would really put a drain on someone's resources available to them. And even previously, we talked in this podcast about, you know, potentially your social battery and how that can run out too. So it's never losing sight of the fact that people are in environments that may or may not be accommodating how they are authentically when they're being themselves, quote unquote. And in times where they're not being accommodated, being able to respond with those alternative options can be helpful. And it is not something that the research suggests can be done sustainably forever and ever, because it's not who they are. It's an option that they're choosing to respond with because it's serving them in that moment. So keeping sight of that too, and also that not being able to perform in those ways, you know, naturally or all the time, is not a personal failing either. Right. It's all systems that are not, you know, supporting or not accommodating or even just accepting as a baseline of different types of expressions, too.
Yeah.
It's so important to hear that. And the way you phrased that, Alison, just I wrote it down. I was typing. I don't know if you noticed that, but I wrote it down because it's such a succinct way to honor the effort it takes. Sort of the function behind it, that this is not an effort to change a person, but it sometimes, because of the world we're in, we have to do it. to
and not co-signing that either. Like, this is the world now, and I really hope that this is not the world forever, right? But that this is the practicality of being a person at this moment. And, you know, it should be the world that changes first, and oftentimes it isn't, or it's changing too slowly, and we've people here in the meantime who are not being given those response options.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and increasingly, and that's why I think it's really important to be led by children and led by the things that they tell us, or led by teens. And I was so happy the beginning of last academic year, where a school invited me in at the, you know, in September to come, not that I was so happy that they specifically invited me, but that, you know, the being asked to come in and speak to teachers about what did I think that, you know, anxious kids needed most, you know, as they broached their teenage years. And this was one of the things I thought they needed most, like these types of accommodation, like when they're overloaded or overwhelmed. A lot of the kids that we see, like I said earlier, are neurodivergent kids, and, you know, they're overwhelmed and overloaded a lot of the time, and they don't have those response options. And so, like, when I'm writing a letter to a school, I might be saying, you know, that kid might not feel like they can raise their hand and say, I'm overloaded now. But they need, and they may not have the assertiveness skills. We're trying to teach those assertiveness skills. We're trying to teach in Magpies and in other programs we're doing, you know, interoceptive awareness. We're trying to teach the language around being able to A, recognize, and B, name what's happening for me in this moment. And then assertiveness that I can say, you know, teacher, I need to leave the room right now. And whatever language I need to lay on that, that I can actually get out of here so that I can, you know, ground myself, so that I can then come back and learn later, so that I can get myself to a place I need to in my life that feels valuable and meaningful for me. But we need to be guided by them. You know, I remember a really interesting thing where a young person I was working with, and they were in a school that was amazing, and the school was actually doing great things, you know, in having, you know, sensory rooms, and in, you know, providing a space where it was safe enough that the kid could actually, you know, leave the room and go and take some, you know, breathing space. But actually the space that the school was providing had like only a round table where the kid was going into this kind of a safe breathing space where they had to kind of sit staring at the other kids that were getting their breathing space. And the kid was like, I can't go to that room. So there was something about just kind of the logistical arrangement of the room that just really wasn't working for the kid. And so when the young person said it to me, I was like, oh, okay, like that, it makes perfect sense. But, you know, nobody had thought of that. And when I rang up the school to say this thing, the school was like, oh, we'll just get the table out of the room. And that was it. It was done. You know, but none of us had thought of it. I had never seen the room, but the young person said it to me. I said it to the school, and the table was gone. You know, and but if the young person hadn't thought to say it to me, if the school hadn't been, you know, open enough and willing enough, you know, that whole thing wouldn't have been changed, you know. But yeah, there's I suppose there's a lot of layers to that.
Yeah. Co-creation if anyone listening to this has worked with me in schools, they will recognize my interventions that I've designed so many interventions that are exactly what you said. How can we allow a child to raise their hand, empower them first, but let them know they won't be punished for it. I need some space. I'm going to go for a walk without needing accompaniment. If this is a child that is safe, you know, is not going to elope from, it's okay. They can go and come back. And I often will use the example of, you know, as an adult, if I am in a meeting and I am having a hard time with my own emotional regulation, I get to excuse myself and step out. And whether I say that I'm using the bathroom or not, nobody's going to stop me. And in schools, seem to be different rules about that. And that doesn't always serve the children.
But of course, we have to create a culture where people can have a voice. Mm-hmm. And if we don't create a culture where people can have a voice, then a young person can never say, I can't have the round table, or I need to leave the room because I'm dysregulated, or I'm anxious, or I'm not feeling safe here.
Right. Okay, so we've touched on emotional regulation and social skills and a little bit about self-esteem. Do you want to say any more about that before we look at?
Do you want to touch on any of the exercises in self-esteem, Allison? Do you want to talk about?
This past year, we've done a number of updates to the self-esteem module. So it's a bit more explicitly aligned with the very nerdy RFT account of the self. But oftentimes what we're trying to do in the self-esteem module is help children to notice that they are not their stories about themselves. They are the person who's storying, or they are the container of all those stories. So I might think I'm an anxious person, or I'm not good enough. And, you know, I might have lots of thoughts and feelings show up when I have those stories shown up. And the point is not whether those are true or not true. The point is that I'm the person who is having those stories. And when they show up, regardless of what they are, I always have a choice about how I'm going to behave or what I'm going to do in that moment. So a lot of the self-esteem exercises focus on that power in your mind doesn't need to be the boss of you. You always have a choice around what you're going to do in this moment.
I'm reminded also, Allison, of our conversation about rules, and sometimes can we look at the rule? And I hear a parallel there, of course, when we have stories about ourselves.
Yeah. Or I think, like, even if my mind thinks it's the boss of me, you know, I like to think that my mind is the kind of boss that I can have a respectful negotiation with. Oh, okay. Well, here's what I'm thinking about that, you know, Mr. Manager. You know, I was thinking there's another way that we might do this, you know, that we can have some respectful negotiation. And actually, when I'm working with kids on social skills, you know, I often work on respectful negotiation and, you know, how do you get your way with your parents when you think one way and they think another way? And, you know, how do we navigate that? Because oftentimes we're coming from different perspectives and, you know, we have different views of the world and there are lots of different agendas at play in the world all of the time, all day long. So, yeah. Lots of layers.
And I love the overlap too, when you were talking about how, you know, a lot regulation and mindfulness, they're woven into the modules as well. And I do want to make sure there's a favorite activity that I have that I've seen in Magpies. I haven't seen all of them, but I really love the ladder.
Metaphor. Oh yes, yeah, yeah.
And I wonder, well, we're not using video in this episode, but I wonder if you can describe that in a way that people might capture in their minds.
So actually, that is one of my very favorites. That's in the emotional regulation, although we can really use it anywhere. But it's basically climbing down the ladder, and I really like the visual of climbing down the ladder, and you'll see elements of DBT in this too. But essentially, if you find yourself at the top of the ladder, so we would talk about kind of, you know, name all of, I mean, I would kind of pick four, you know, anger, sadness, happiness, fear. So you'll see how that can really, you know, that could fit in an anxiety module too. But a lot of times people that come to us, let's say for anger, might struggle with all of their emotions because, you know, regulation is not just about anger. Regulation really is about, you know, feeling your feelings, which is a normal thing to do, feel your feelings. So we'd talk about all the feelings and we would try to evoke lots of different words for all the different feelings. And I would draw out the ladders with the child in session, and we would kind of just put them loosely on the steps of a ladder, and we would try to put them in order, you know, roughly from the highest intensity emotion. So, you know, head exploding rage is the top of the ladder, and just, you know, mildly annoyed might be the bottom of the ladder, and then, you know, anger, and, you know, all the other ones might be in the middle. And we would talk about some situations, and we do that for each of the emotions, and we would talk about some situations that might be, you know, head exploding rage, and, you know, all the way down to the mild annoyance. And you know, we would talk about if you found yourself, you know, what are the sort of situations that might have you at head exploding rage? What are the sort of situations that might have you kind of in the, you know, in the middle of a ladder? What are the sort of situations that might have you at the bottom of a ladder? What might it be like for you versus what might it be like for me? We would kind of bring it around the group too, and you know, just sort of try to evoke from the group, you know, how it might be interesting that, like, you know, maybe for Allison there might be something that might be head exploding rage for her that might be just a mild annoyance for me, and something that, you know, maybe the exact same situation might be middle of the ladder for you, Katie. And, you know, then we've kind of, you know, go through that. But the idea is, and this is a real kind of an RFT exercise too, that you're sort of seeing in a really visual way, you know, that's something that's way up here might be way down here. We might also talk about, like, different times of the day, how, like, if you're really exhausted, you know, something that might be head exploding rage for you when you're really exhausted might be middle of the ladder on another day when you're well rested. So the ladder, really, you know, the idea of kind of drawing out the ladder, you know, it's sort of like getting all this difficult stuff that you're thinking and feeling, but you're kind of putting it all on the ladder. There's a lot of, like, you know, really kind of fruitful discussion point around it. There's also a lot of fruitful discussion point, you know, between and among the group and the other members of the group. And then we would also do sort of some kind of strategizing. If you find yourself at the top of the ladder, what are some of the things that you might do to sort of climb down and get to the bottom? And we might also use a lot of the language of grounding, you know, you physically get to the ground, you know, to bring yourself down to a place where you can kind of walk on to the rest of your day. Do you want to add some to that, Allison? We do the other ladders too.
I think the ladders seem to be really effective noticing tools for noticing, like, oh, there's a version of me who's at the top of the ladder, and there's also a version of me at another point in another context who's at a different point in that ladder. And a lot of the discussion points around the ladder focus on, you know, what are your go-to actions, or what are things that you do when you're at the top of this ladder? And oftentimes people might say that the things at the top of the ladder are really understandably challenging for them to experience. So they're doing things that they wouldn't necessarily want to be doing, or things that aren't necessarily helping them. So then from that place of, okay, we're not necessarily doing the things that are working for us, how can we shift and change to actually get to a place where we're able to do the things that are more likely to work for us? So it's never condemning any particular emotion. You know, you want to be the top of the ladder, be the top of the ladder, as long as you're doing things that are going to serve you in the long run.
That's one of my favorite points about, I mean, even the whole program is this idea of non-judging. It's not, the goal is not necessarily be at a particular place on the ladder. It's, where am I? How am I impacting others? How am I impacting my own forward movement? And do I want to do anything about that? Do I need to or want to, in this context, move myself up and down the ladder, and how do I do that? And I love using the here's some more air quotes that other people can't see, but the positive emotions, if you will, like happy, like what's the top of the happy ladder? You know, for me is really when I'm at the top of the joy bursting out of my pores, I'm obnoxious to be around. And so, like, does it serve me when I'm by myself or with my pets? Yeah, everybody's happy. You know, we can all handle it. But if I am at the top of that ladder in a room full of people who really aren't sharing that experience with me, it's not maybe going to serve me as, you know, as a respected professional, let's say, if I was in a professional environment.
And it's really interesting that you say that, because when we do the happy ladder, I always make sure, because of course we really tend to polarize these things, like anger is bad and happy is good, and make sure you're on the happy ladder all day long. But I always make sure to point out, you know, actually none of these are good or bad, or, you know, these are just your feelings, you know. Yeah. And I always make sure to point out, you know, are there times when, you know, being really happy may not be, you know, the most you know, the best choice for that moment. And I would, you know, make a comment of like, you know, I remember being a kid and being in mass and like, you know, laughing my head off and getting in a lot of trouble, you know, and you know, or like being at, you know, Irish dancing class, and myself and my friend Martina actually got thrown out of Irish dancing because we were laughing so hard that it was, of course, really disruptive to the rest of the class. And I remember like making jokes and laughing really hard when I was in a taekwondo class with my brother. And I did this thing where I was a really small kid, and my instruction was to flip the master. Master Chung was his name. And I had to flip him over. I was so surprised that I was able to do it. and I followed the instruction perfectly, and I flipped Master Chung. And it, the whole thing surprised me so much. And I put my hand on my hip and I waved my finger at him. And I was like, and another thing, you know, because I was so delighted with myself. And myself and my brother were just rolling around the place. We were laughing so hard. And Master Chung, and the whole rest of the class just looked at us like this had never been done in Taekwondo before. And like to this day, myself and my brother laugh so hard, like about me wagging my finger, you know, at the master.
And it's a perfect example of a place where just extraordinary delight and joy. Fantastic. But how we express it. In that context,
was not an appropriate thing to do in that moment. And I still think it's hilarious. And I'm sure everybody else in my Taekwondo class to this day still thinks it was the most outrageously inappropriate thing they ever saw in a Taekwondo class. Where myself and my Taekwondo teacher might put that on a ladder would be probably diametrically opposed, and I'm okay with that. and that's okay, you know, and I feel like that's okay, you know, like we don't have to agree on the ladders. Our perspectives might be different. We need to think about what's going to work for us long term, and we don't even have to agree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And back to what Allison, you were saying about choice points, like recognizing that there are choice points along the way, and then tying in that idea of a social skill that can broaden our behavioral repertoire, if you will, give us a broader set of choices to make in those choice points. Are we missing, what other modules are there? I do feel that like I could dive deeply into all of these.
So anxiety is the last one. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk a little bit about anxiety, Allison? I just feel like I've been talking a lot.
I think it makes sense for you to talk about anxiety and to plug the the upcoming projects.
So yeah, I'm the anxiety. Oh, the art club projects, of course. Yeah, so we did some very exciting art club projects, which we've talked a little bit about, Katie. And the art club projects were basically we invited some kids that were attending the clinic, and we've run a number of art clubs. Excuse me. Stumbling on my words at this stage. And the kids that were involved in the art club were invited to attend Louth Meath Education Training Board. Actually, I should name them because they have been so, so great to us in letting us use their rooms. And they have this great big old home ec room. And so all throughout COVID, we were able to safely run art clubs. And the kids that took part in art clubs, both for Tired of Anxiety, the first book, and Tired of Anxiety, the second book, they met with us and read the books and, you know, went through and did all the exercises. And a lot of the exercises in the anxiety module, you'll also see in the Tired of Anxiety books. And so those have really been co-created, and the artwork in the books, you know, you'll see has been done by the kids that attended the art clubs. We also did a very cool project with our local libraries, where some of the kids that attended the local libraries also sent in some artwork. And so, yeah, there was just a lot of very, very cool projects where kids were really being exposed, to some of the things that made them anxious. They were talking about the things that made them anxious with other kids and meeting on a weekly basis. So yeah, it was just very cool. And we also did, actually, there was one other thing I wanted to say, Allison, I don't know if you remember this exercise. But it was a very cool exposure exercise. And we had some pictures. Hopefully we'll be able to show it in one of our ACBS presentations, where we never ask a kid in any of the Magpies modules or any of our training groups, we never ask a kid to do something that the group leaders are not themselves willing to do. And so we had a great one with one of our group leaders, Amy Russell, who she had a lot of, I think, foods she was afraid to try. And so the kids laid out one of the exercises is it's kind of a mindfulness thing too, where it's like, you know, you cover out the tray and you have to close your eyes and, like, you know, with curiosity approach, you know, what might this food be, and then put one in your mouth. But Amy is quite an anxious eater. And, you know, probably a little bit of an ARFID kid, or was an ARFID kid herself. So this was a really anxiety provoking activity for her. But the sweetest thing ever was that one of the Magpies kids came and was, like, in the photo standing behind Amy with her hand on her shoulder. And there was another kid that brought her teddy with her every week to Magpies. And in the photo, she was handing Amy her teddy. And so Amy had her eyes closed really, really tight and was, like, reaching out for one of the foods, and Amy was clearly terrified and going for it anyway. But, you know, the idea is that we don't ask the kids to do anything that we are not ourselves willing to do. But I just thought, like, I wasn't there at that session, but I could just see everything in that photo, like the child's kind of supporting Amy in modeling the activity. It's just a really, really beautiful demonstration of what we're trying to achieve. You know, the art clubs did it, but the, you know, the Magpies groups really, you know, looking at this with curiosity and bravery, you know, so we're not ever saying this is easy. We're saying, you know, let's do it, you know, in the service of living a life, you know, going for it. You know, we're not saying it's easy, but, you know, let's do it. And we can't do it for you, but we will hold your hand in the dark. And what I saw in that photo was the kids holding Amy's hand.
Yeah. How beautiful. Mm-hmm. Alison, do you have a favorite component of that module, that anxiety module?
One thing I really like is that some of the exercises talk about anxiety monsters and, you know, what might be things we do that feed our anxiety monsters. But then the module will kind of flip how we're understanding monster. So from this horrible thing that's totally unapproachable to, you know, your mind is doing its job. And we might be calling it a monster, but, you know, there can be friendly monsters, there can be monsters looking out for us. And a lot of times that's what our anxious minds might be doing, is just trying to keep us safe. So I really love those activities, and they're also more art-based, which tend to be my favorite ones anyway. You didn't ask me this, but I'm going to say it anyway, because I just think it's beautiful. But in the most recent running of the anxiety module in Magpies, in the last session, we had this gorgeous kid who came in with a lot of anxiety, and in the final session they had gotten stuck in the restroom, like the door had locked and there was no way for anyone to get in. Here is this kid who came in with a lot of anxiety from the onset anyway, who was now in this really, I would say, anxiety inducing situation, and the kid was just coping extremely well, like patiently waiting for people to open the door. And, you know, of course there are adults there standing like, oh, we're getting someone, we're just calling maintenance, they'll come and fix the door. And the kid was just coping so well, possibly better than I would have coped in that moment, because I can imagine my anxious self, you know, really panicking or stressing. I guess panic is the wrong word there. But I think it just really spoke to me about the kind of gains and skills that the kid had gotten from that anxiety module. Because here you are literally in this, you know, really anxiety inducing situation, and you're managing, you're getting through it.
And tying on to that, there was something that I learned in the first training that I attended about Magpies. And I have not been able to re-articulate it well, so I'm hoping one of you can. And it has to do with the cycles of four breathing. And there's research about three cycles of eight, or can you explain that a little bit? And yes. And I'll tell you why first, because I occasionally have panic attacks and I don't always know where they're coming from or when. And the last two times that it has happened to me, I have used that specific breathing exercise, and it has allowed me to not feel the distress of the panic attack, but just watch it go by. And so I'm fascinated by this? So that's a little bit why I'm asking.
So that comes from, I'm going to say two things. Actually, let me add one thing to Allison's story really fast.
Great. Yeah, yeah.
Really hilarious bit of the end of that story is that the kid said at the end, was this a test? And I passed. And it wasn't a test. He thought, like, at the very end of Magpies, everybody gets locked in the loo. And of course, that doesn't happen at Magpies. There was just a really dodgy lock on the bathroom. And we're like, you definitely passed. And we promise you this wasn't a test. And you did absolutely amazing, out of this world. We are so proud of you. If it was a test, you passed. Like, you are getting the biggest prize and ribbon known to personkind. So yeah, that was just a very funny addition to Allison.
Talk about self-efficacy and self-esteem building, right? Like, I got it, I did it.
Yeah, he really, really did it. So the what you're talking about is soothing rhythm breathing. And that actually comes from, and there's lots of different data on this, but I first heard that, I first heard Russell Coltz talking about soothing rhythm breathing in a training he did on the ACT MBI course years ago. And it's in through your nose for 4, out through your mouth for 6, times a cycle of 3. And that is enough to turn off your amygdala and turn back on your prefrontal cortex. So I will often, and in the Magpie series, or when I have a kid here for individual therapy, I will often show them a very overly simplified picture of a brain and say, you know, do you see this tiny little, you know, bean-shaped piece of your brain called the amygdala? You know, when you start to get really anxious, your amygdala kicks in. When your amygdala, you know, jumps into fight or flight, you can pretty much do nothing else, only fight, flight, or freeze. And when that happens, your prefrontal cortex, or your thinking and reasoning brain, that essentially goes offline. So you're not using your best thinking and reasoning skills. But if you do your soothing rhythm breathing, you know, that's a really good way of down-regulating your whole limbic system and turning back on your thinking and reasoning brain. So that's the part of your brain that can get you through the maths test or, you know, do all the other things that you might need to do on that day. And so I will do it with a child. So in through your nose for 4. And I actually count it on my hands and out through your mouth for 6. I will also tell them when you're initially doing that, it might not feel like you've got 6 seconds of out breath, but the more you practice that, the bigger your lung capacity will get. Let's do it together. In through your nose for 4, out through your mouth for 6, times a cycle of 3. If you feel like your amygdala has been triggered again, do it again. Do as many cycles as you need, you know, until you feel, you know, grounded enough to carry on about your business, doing whatever it is you need to do to carry on about your day. And know that, you know, when that, you know, when your amygdala gets triggered, or if you don't like the language of getting triggered, you don't have to use that. But when your amygdala gets set off, that's just your brain doing its job. That's just your brain trying to keep you safe. That's what brains do. It's what minds do. That's okay. You know, nobody's going to beat you up about that. That is just your alarm system doing its job. Some of us have super sensitive alarm systems. Sometimes that's really, really useful. Sometimes when you look around the world, you just say, actually, you know what? This is just a maths test. This is just a super noisy birthday party. I don't actually need an alarm right now. So I'm going to do a little bit more deep breathing until my amygdala has, you know, switched off. My prefrontal cortex is switched back on and I can go on about my day again. So that is soothing rhythm breathing, and it is turning off your amygdala when it turns out you don't actually need it right now. Is that okay?
Great. Thank you. Yes.
But funny enough, and it's so silly that like a picture of a brain, and I don't know why, but like kids and their parents really believe that. And I mean, I actually know like plenty of people that have neuroscience as their background, and I am not one of them, but like somehow this like wildly oversimplified version That I always really hope there's no real neuroscientists in the audience, because I'm sure if they hear me explaining that, they're probably inwardly groaning at my wildly overly simplified version of that. But somehow it's like, you know, the deep breathing accompanied by a picture of a brain, they're like, aha, okay, this I can do. And somehow that like feels believable and gets kids doing a little bit of breathing and like, okay, I'm just going to turn on the bit of my brain that works for me right now when I need to do my maths test. Let's do it. And that, you know, seems to be an effective thing to do when, you know, you feel overwhelmed and, you know, you need to do something a little bit different. Fantastic. It works for me too, actually. Works for me too. And I always apologize that I'm sorry there's not a cooler thing to call this, but you know, that's what it's called in the CFT literature, and that's what I carry on with. So that's soothing rhythm breathing.
Fantastic. I'm just noticing once again what time it is, and being mindful that it is Friday afternoon, late Friday afternoon for both of you. And I want to make sure that we've covered, is there anything else you want to share with parents before we wrap up and say goodbye?
I think I am okay.
Thank you both so much for being here, for talking about this program, for giving us such an in-depth look at not just where it came from, but sort of the deep science and rich feedback behind its development. It sounds really, really beautiful.
Thank you so much, Katie. Thank you so much for having us. It's really, really close to my heart and, you know, close to all the kids that are attending here in the clinic. And it has definitely been a labor of love for us, and I've been, you know, really, really lucky to have this extraordinary team with me, and especially, you know, Allison Stapleton and Elle Kirsten have really been, you know, have really just kind of escalated the delivery of the program and the, you know, the collection of the data. So that's really kind of refined it so much. So we've been really, really lucky. And really, really excited and delighted to be invited to talk to you about this thing that's so important to us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for spending some time with us. Please consider checking out the website, www.vigiobx.com, to find more helpful resources from our guests and from other professionals using acceptance and commitment training to support parents and children. You can leave comments or requests on the podcast page, find more information about our guests, and subscribe to our newsletter as well. We have a recommended book list, a blog, and options for a free 30-minute consultation if you're interested in working with us. Go gently and have a great day.